Good morning and welcome to St. Paul's Bible Study. We have we're still in the Gospel of Thomas, and I beg your patience as people come into the meeting. We'll begin in just a moment. Good morning, Grace. How are you? I can't hear you yet, but it's that you're connecting to audio, so just give it half a second. All right, Jeanette, we can't hear you yet, but it does say that you're connecting to audio. Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. Sometimes it does take just a couple of minutes to get the technology working properly. Give whoever else would like to arrive just a moment or two to come. What's up, Jeanette?
I'm using a different computer. I'm using my tablet, not my computer, not my laptop, to see if the sound works better.
Well, the sound quality is really excellent right now.
It is. Okay, yes. Good. Oh, perfect.
So, yeah.
Yeah, the screen is a little smaller because it's my tablet, not in, you know, not my computer, but that's right. Okay.
Right.
It's still quite large.
Excellent. How are you ladies keeping cool today?
Oh, it's supposed to get to 90 today. Wow.
Staying in the air conditioning.
Yes.
Excellent. Good job. Well, it may just be us today. So why don't we go ahead and dig in? Mm-hmm. Let's see. Last time we ended just before saying 40. So we are now looking at saying 40. I'll go ahead and read that for us. Yeshua said, "A grapevine planted away from the Father has no vitality. It will be torn up by its roots and will perish." Let's let that sink in for a moment in silence, and then we'll begin our discussion. What do you make of saying number 40?
The whole thing is confusing. What does it mean to be planted outside of the Father?
Okay. Good question. Grace, what's your take on it? Does it seem to make sense? Do you not have an opinion on this one, Grace?
Well, for some reason you cut out and you just came back.
Oh,
I'm sorry. What's your opinion, Grace?
Well, I'm thinking the grapevine might be the word of God and it needs to be rooted.
Okay. That's a good guess. One of the things that's helpful to recognize is that this is an agricultural metaphor. So first of all, it's an agricultural metaphor. It would have been very, very familiar to the people that Jesus was speaking to originally. And in fact, the actual specific agricultural metaphor of a grapevine, it just repeats over and over and over in the Bible. We see it in the Old Testament, we see it in the New Testament. So it would have been an image that was very, very familiar. They would have been familiar with images of God's vineyard and God's grapevine, and we are God's grapevine. We are God's harvest. Those would have been familiar concepts to them. So then Jesus coming along and saying, you know, pulling on all of those grapevine images that are already in their heads and saying, a grapevine planted away from the Father has no life. It's got no oomph. It's not going to blossom. It'll be torn up by its roots and it'll perish. So first of all, one of the things that the people are going to immediately recognize is the image of God in the midst of prophecy to one of the prophets, saying, you know, you are my planted grapevine, but I'm so angry at you that I will tear down the walls around you, and I will tear down the watchtower near you, and I will let the wild beasts trample over you and feast upon you. And that was imagery that they would have been familiar with as part of the give and play, the give and take of a prophecy. Hi, Sue. We're discussing saying 40. That image would have been part of the give and take of a well-known prophecy. Now, the thing about the harsh moments of a prophet speaking God's will to the people is that there's always, like, if you don't shape up, I'm gonna smack you across the face. And then there's the other side of the prophecy. Now that you've shaped up, we can rebuild our relationship. So there's always that ugly moment in a prophecy where God is threatening complete destruction. And that can be a hard thing for modern audiences to wrestle with. But the point here is not necessarily to wrestle with that issue, but to recognize this is going to be a common thought for the people who are hearing this for the first time. God and vineyards, the potential for destruction if you do something wrong, and the potential for amazing growth if you do something right. So then focusing just on saying 40, just that. A grapevine planted away from the Father has no vitality. It will be torn up by its roots. It will perish. If we take that on a more spiritual level, we can look at the Word of God, just like Grace suggested. We can look at it as nurturing our relationship with God the Father directly. We can look at it as living in the spiritual life. You know, there's a lot of different ways to interpret that that all kind of revolve around something very, very similar, but a healthy spiritual relationship with God. And if you can think of, you know, planting your grapevines in the healthy soil of a solid, good, growing, nurtured relationship with God, those grapevines will flourish. But if you plant your grapevines over there amidst the asphalt and the concrete of the idolatry of money and the idolatry of goods and the idolatry of politics and the idolatry of everything that isn't God, all the things that we humans tend to value and put over and above our own spiritual needs that are met by God, those are grapevines that will wither. They're just going to. Those are grapevines that are going to get torn up. That's just a fact of life. And it's not necessarily that God's going to come as some kind of avenging deity and tear up all the things that aren't planted in him, but rather the only thing that's really going to blossom and flourish is what you plant inside of this relationship that you have with God. That's where your most fertile soil is going to be found. That's where all the compost is. That's where the balance of nutrients resides. And everything else is like, you know, you got dandelions growing in the cracks of the concrete. It's a miracle that you can see dandelions growing in the cracks of the concrete. And who knows? The dandelions might be reclaiming that concrete. Just give them time. Just give them time. But dandelions can grow there, but apple trees can't. Healthy vines for a grape plant can't. And so leave it to the dandelions. That's my interpretation. Does that help, Jeanette, or is it still kind of obscure?
No, that helps, sure. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Okay. Sue, you want to weigh in on saying 40 and what you think about it?
Well, I came kind of late to the game.
That's okay.
And so I was quickly reading it while you were speaking. And I'm very glad for your comments because it's harsh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're gonna get into some harsh ones today.
And it's harsh. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I feel like we're soft. Mm-hmm. And so it scrapes and scratches and you wonder, so what's the use? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, you can, if you think yeah. about it too much in one direction. So your comments help kind of show that there's mercy and that it's still a caring God. Mm-hmm. We just have to think about it differently. Sometimes.
Right. And, you know, and it's tricky because one of the ancient precepts that our spiritual ancestors gave to us, and by spiritual ancestors, I'm talking Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob here, our most ancient spiritual ancestors that we share with the Jewish faith and the Islamic faith. They really deeply believed that absolutely everything in their immediate environment, in their personal world, in the wider world, in all that exists, was caused directly and intimately, like a micromanager, by God. The wind blows because God wants it to blow at you. The grain sprouts and begins to grow because God wills that grain to grow. And that's an okay way to look at the world. It doesn't always allow for reason, logic, and scientific observation. And remember, science is not magic. Science is simply observing things very, very closely and beginning to understand what we see by very close observation and the use of reason and logic laid over our observations. So the tricky thing here is that if you hold up this ancient ideal that God micromanages everything, then it's really hard to allow anything else to come into that bubble of protection, of protected space. Now, some of you know that I was raised by a scientist and a mystic, which is a fascinating combination, and I highly recommend it for all. But what that means is that the scientist and mystic who raised me was very clear that God is more intelligent than we are. God has always been more intelligent than we are. God will always be more intelligent than we are. And if we have discovered engineering, it is only because God has gone there before us. If we have discovered DNA, it is only because God has gone there before us. If we have discovered anything in the scientific or medicinal realm, it is because God has gone there before us. And there is nothing that God did not create. That God is the chief architect and the highest engineer and the largest doctor and the most important, fill in the blank. And so it's very much a marriage of these spiritual concepts and these religious concepts and scientific advancement. And when the scientist and mystic who raised me looked at the ancient scriptures that say God made the world in 7 days, things like this, he had no problem with that. He had no problem taking it as literally as possible. And also saying those were ancient cultures. They described things the best way they knew how. God bless them. Mm-hmm. They did the best they can. And so the difficult part is that we still have this undercurrent in our own culture that is left over from the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob notion that absolutely everything is caused by a micromanaging God who is pissed off at you. And the subtext is, who is pissed off at you? But everything is caused by a micromanaging God. And that lingers in our modern life. When calamity befalls and we think, what did I do wrong? When we have cancer or fill in the blank with another illness, heart attack, stroke, a fall that breaks a hip, reduced mobility. And we think, is God punishing me? Or perhaps we just go straight to the source and start yelling at God, why are you doing this to me? Haven't I been a good person? What's wrong? And what I love about saying 40 is that it's pointing to the reality of a broken world where we have free will, we have a choice. We can put our attention and our focus and our energies and our priorities on building and planting in the best possible space, on the best possible ground, with the best possible foundation, over here on top of God, metaphorically speaking. Or we have a choice to plant anywhere else, to build anywhere else. And when we do plant in other places, and when we do build in other places, it's going to crumble faster. All structures are unstable. Everything crumbles eventually. Everything dies eventually. That's part of this broken world. It's not God who broke the world. But God helps us to find a way through the broken world to live with as much joy and peace and contentment as we are possibly capable of embracing. And there's going to be some difficult sayings that point to a broken world and how do we get through it without losing our minds and our faith. So this is my concluding thoughts on saying 40. Further thoughts, one last thing. Okay. Let's move on to saying 41. Jeanette, since your audio is so fantastic, why don't you read it for us?
41, more and less. Jesus said, whoever has something in hand will be given more, but whoever doesn't have anything will lose even what little they do have.
Okay, let's let that hard one sit for a moment or two of silence as we think about it. you make of saying 41?
One in the hand is worth two in the bush.
Okay.
So that's the colloquial thing that kind of came through the years, probably from something exactly like this. So our cultures just keep passing it along.
Mm-hmm. But how does someone, whoever doesn't have anything, I mean, what does that mean, whoever doesn't have anything? Is that fit is spiritually, physically, emotionally, or is it a whole ball of wax? I don't understand.
Okay. Grace, what do you think? Where are you on this one?
Are you speaking to me?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Grace, where are you on saying 41?
Well, I'm thinking it's like giving unconditionally. If you, okay, whatever you have, you should share. Take care of the widows and the needy.
Okay. It certainly does remind you of sayings that talk about that. Yeah. So we do hear this general theme in the canonical gospels. There are some references in the bottom of mine. It's the parable of the talents. And if you remember the story, great. If you don't, it's the one where he's, first of all, Jesus is telling a story. So it's not just like in saying 41, Jesus is straight up giving a piece of wisdom. It's softened in the gospels. He's telling a story about a wealthy master who goes away. He's got three servants. He gives them each sort of according to their capacity. He gives them a certain amount of money. To one, he gives a huge fortune. To one, he gives a moderate fortune. To one, he gives, you know, a bit of money. And each one is able to give something back to the master when he comes back. So the one who had the huge fortune, he made an even bigger fortune with it. The one who had the moderate fortune made an even bigger fortune with it. The one with the very small amount of money, but, you know, still something you could do something with, was terrified and buried it in the backyard. When the master came home, he dug it up and said, okay, here, it's what's yours. Because I know that you're a harsh and terrible master and you reap where you do not sow. And, you know, that's another harsh lesson from Jesus, because while his students may have commiserated with the guy who was given two talents, and while his students might have commiserated with the guy who was given two talents when he says, you know, I know you're a harsh master and you reap where you don't sow. And so I thought I better cover my own butt and just play it safe. The master goes a little crazy on him. And so it's almost easier to just see the plain wisdom here. And I think that I think that Jesus is talking about something spiritual rather than physical. Because if you think about it, if we talk about something physical, I have in my office at present one to-go cup. It doesn't have any more coffee in it, but there is one to-go cup in my office. And if I give it away, there will be exactly zero to-go cups in my office. So the amount of to-go cups in my life is a zero-sum game. Meaning I have one. If I give it to Jeanette, I have zero. And Jeanette has one more. Okay, so that's the physical world. I have a hand fan. It's delightful. It's very useful. I don't have air conditioning. If I give my hand fan away, then I will not have this hand fan. I have two in my life. If I give it away, I will only have one. So these are your standard mathematical word problems for eight-year-olds. Okay. The spiritual life doesn't work like that. If I have peace in my life, say I have what I would consider a half measure of peace, it's not as peaceful as I can get if I really work at it. But I've got some peace today. If I give that peace to someone else, I don't have less peace. I actually have more peace. because I have been peaceful with someone. I have shared the peace that I have. And simply by them having more peace, I also get more peace. So that works differently. And it's the same thing with love. If I have a certain amount of love in my heart this morning, only so much, because maybe it was a tough morning, but I have a certain amount of love. And if I go to my eldest sister's house, who has kittens living under her deck in the backyard, because a stray cat came along and had kittens underneath her back deck. And I sit very quietly, and the kittens creep out. And the kittens are playful and lovely. And there I am sitting with my half measure of love. Really, I could have more. It would be nice. And I just quietly give those kittens love. And they're kittens, and I like cats. So they're being adorable and playful and rolling and tumbling all over each other. And maybe one comes close enough that I can touch its nose. I'm giving love to those cats, even though they won't let me touch them. And suddenly, even though I've given love away, the amount of love I have is greater. So what does it look like then? Let's pull an example from politics. Think of Vladimir Putin. How much love in his heart do you imagine President Vladimir Putin has right now?
Zero.
Okay, good guess. Whether it's zero or whether it's an absolutely indiscernibly tiny amount, giving him the benefit of the doubt, whoever has nothing, even the little that they have will be taken away. Think of it in terms not of coffee cups and hand fans, but love and peace. Even the person who has no love in their heart, what little they can grab onto, they're not going to be able to keep. And that seems so harsh and so difficult. But if you don't want to be a loving person, you've made a choice that God does not countermand. And you've got to actually choose to start wanting to have a little love, wanting to have a little peace. And the inertia might be very difficult at first. They say the journey of 1,000 steps is not the difficult part. It's the first step that is the difficult part. Mm-hmm.
I don't think Putin even understands the concept of love.
Right. And so there we go.
Faintest ideas to what it is.
There we go. And that is right now the perfect example for us. Mm-hmm. Not that we don't hope Putin won't have a change of heart and actually embrace love in his life, because that would be awesome. Mm-hmm. That would be a great miracle. Mm-hmm. But it's actually, you know, that's between him. That's between Mr. Putin and his maker. Just like how much I want to embrace love and compassion and peace in my life is between me and my maker. Mm-hmm. Likewise, you and your maker. But does that give a little bit of insight into how this can be not quite so hideous a saying? Because on the surface, it's pretty hideous. It's like, wow, that's harsh. Pardon the odd shadows in my frame. I'm fanning myself. Further thoughts on saying 41?
I think it's interesting, just from the human perspective, as you were saying about how when you give the one thing you have away, but you know that you have, like the love, you give some love away. You didn't have much to begin with this morning because of circumstances, but you are not loveless because you gave it away. You have more. Yes. And I think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
What if you really stop to try to think about it, that God has made it possible for us to realize that we have a very good feeling when we give it away.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And we're much more of a curmudgeon when we hold fast to it, because damn it, it's been a tough morning and I needed every bit of goodness I have in myself.
Right.
So I just think it's an amazing, one of those gifts we maybe never even thought about, how mm-hmm. good we feel when we give something away.
Yes.
Or mm-hmm. something of ourselves away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To help somebody else, and we see their face relax, or we see their hand quit clenching. And so, you know, you've done some little tiny thing that made somebody feel a little tiny better. You feel immensely better. Mm-hmm. You go skipping down the hospital hallway or whatever because somebody feels better because you smiled at them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Good point.
And I would go so far as to say that that is the beginning of discernment. That good feeling that you have when you bring others joy or when you offer love and it's received, because let's be honest, it's not always received well.
True.
And sometimes there are troubles in communication.
Yeah,
but when it, exactly, mm-hmm. when it works, when mm-hmm. it works, it's a wonderful feeling. That wonderful feeling is the spirit inside of us saying, mm-hmm. yes, you chose well, good job.
Mm-hmm.
And when we don't have that wonderful feeling, maybe not so effervescent, but even a slight, yeah, that's got a good feel to it. Being able to know what we feel when we feel it is one of the foundation stones of discerning the presence of God in our lives. And you might think to yourself, well, Sarah, everybody knows what they're feeling when they feel it. No, no, well, not everyone knows.
Yeah, Putin doesn't, even the pain that he gives so freely, he doesn't feel that pain.
Right. And we could, I do enjoy using Putin as an example, because sometimes I think it's really helpful to have a really big overblown example, the biggest example we can find. But sometimes it can be more helpful to have a smaller example, something a little closer to home, a little bit more relatable perhaps. And so, you know, in my younger years, I know I'm much younger than all y'all, but you know, I am in my mid 40s, so I have younger years. You know, there was a time when I really couldn't discern what I was feeling when I was feeling it. And if I was lucky, I could figure out 6 months later. And I remember this specifically because about 20 years ago, I had a conversation with my best friend about this and my desire to get to close that gap from 6 months to maybe, you know, like the next day or something. You know, that's an admirable goal. And where that came from was growing up in a household where it was not safe for me to feel my emotions. It just wasn't. And I took that with me into adulthood, beyond living in that house, beyond living with those people. And it stayed with me until I decided to change it. Had to notice it, had to figure out it was an issue, a problem I didn't want, had to take discernible steps to be different. And that took a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take a household of trauma to create in a person a desire to not notice what they're thinking and what they're feeling. And the desire to notice what you're thinking and what you're feeling is called self-awareness. And some people are more self-aware than others, and it doesn't make them better people. it just makes them more aware of what's going on inside, what's going on, I can speak, inside their heads and inside their hearts.
And part of that would be also, if you want to extend it, is what effect am I having on other people? You know, be careful what you say to people, be careful how you act with them, you know, because sometimes gestures and facial expressions and they communicate, you know, so you gotta be a little bit careful. And then to extend that even further, it's interesting to think about how other people are, whether or not they're thinking about their effect on other people. I mean, you can kind of, you know, keep it going outward.
Right, right. And, mm-hmm. you know, I married a man who is on the spectrum. He's very, very slightly on the edge of the autistic spectrum. He's toward the Asperger's end. And it's taken him a lot of training to be able to read other people mm-hmm. and figure out from, you know, the natural social cues, what mm-hmm. they're thinking and how they're responding to him. Mm-hmm. And it's also taken him some training and some work to figure out what he's sending out in the unspoken signals category. Mm-hmm. And we actually wonder if he is on the spectrum or not, or if he just absorbed the way his father was in the world, and his father is definitely on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And the further and further away he is from his father, and the more work he does, the more he realizes, this isn't actually natural to me. It's not, you know, it's not in my machine code, but it feels normal because this is how I was raised. And that's the tricky thing, because what feels normal to us is how we were raised, whether it was good or bad or mm-hmm. shady or ideal. Mm-hmm. That's what feels good. Normal.
But it's good that you can think about it and compensate and change. You know, you don't exactly. have to remain the product of your childhood. I mean, exactly. people do change.
They absolutely.
And it's better if you think about help yourself change in the right direction rather than just kind of blindly reacting to things. So.
And there we have the vine that's planted inside the father. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that would be a metaphorical example of, you know, I want to make healthy, positive, good, useful changes in my life mm-hmm. to let go of those things that didn't help me from my childhood. Because, right. you know, my childhood wasn't terrible. Lots and lots of things I got from my childhood were super helpful, and I'm so glad I experienced them. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to throw away the baby with the bathwater.
That's for sure. Right.
But a few things, you know, needed to change.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think that's true of all of us, all of us. Right.
Mm-hmm. And because I am who I am, I did that inside of a lot of prayer. And it came to me in prayer. And there were years and years and years of asking God, show me a better way to be. Mm-hmm. Give mm-hmm. me examples of how to do this. Mm-hmm. And so that was me planting the vines that were my responsibility to plant, not ones that were planted on my behalf, planting my vines as well as I could inside the Father.
As a matter of fact, sometimes you wish you could get inside of someone else's head to understand why they're doing what they're doing, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah. that's true in a lot of situations, especially with people that you're close to, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yep, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Further thoughts on saying 41? All right, let's move on to the ultra short saying 42. Sue, do you want to read that one for us?
Yeshua said, be passers-by.
Okay, let's let that sink in for a moment of silence. What do you think?
I'm confused because sometimes it seems like when you're passing by, you should do something because something's going on that's wrong. And in another case, passing by is okay and not interfering, so to speak, with what's going on. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Good observations. What else?
Well, on the surface, it sounds like kind of mind your own business.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But should you always do that? That's the question.
But that's not the Christian, you know, so to speak, that's not the Christian way of living your life. We're supposed to
love one another and look up for one another and not just be passersby.
Yeah. So,
help when needed.
Yeah. Because the passerby and these Good Samaritan, they're the ones that all the way through our cultural history have been criticized for passing by.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of weird that we're being told to be passersby. What's Thomas saying to us?
Grace, what do you think about this one?
It reminds me of I don't remember which book it's in, but the priest and somebody else walked by a man that was injured, and the Samaritan came along and took him to, picked him up and took him to an inn to heal him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep, just like Sue was mentioning. So here's a thing that might be tripping us up. It may be that Jesus means something different than our common culture now thinks of passersby, that word. So Sue and Grace both pointed out the parable of the Good Samaritan. All three were passersby. The priest, the Levite, the Samaritan. All three. Two chose something different with the act of passing by. One is our example for how to be a good neighbor, how to be ultimate in loving someone else. He was also a passerby. He stopped, he paused, he did something beautiful and good. He took the man with him to the nearest inn and gave them money to take care of him. The Samaritan did not stay at the inn. The Samaritan said, "The next time I come by, if you've incurred any expense over and above the modest fortune I have just given you to take care of this man, I'll pay you back." And then the Samaritan continued on and continued to be a passerby, which should shake up our notions of what it means to be a passerby. So one of the things that the commentary points out is that nothing in this world is quite as permanent as we like to imagine that it is. Our houses are not quite as permanent as we like to imagine they are. Our health is not quite as permanent as we like to imagine it is. Our bodies and our lives are impermanent. And a lot of suffering can come when we look at something that is impermanent and decide we want it to stay forever. Decide it ought to stay forever. Decide it should stay forever. Decide we're going to make it stay forever. Because disappointment comes along. What do you make of saying 42 with those ideas bopping around in your head? Does it begin to look different?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To be a good passerby.
Mm-hmm.
To give so that you have more.
It's almost as if Thomas should not have left that so short. It doesn't mean anything by itself. I mean, the author is a little lacking in communication.
Yeah, a little description might have been nice on that one, huh?
Yep.
Yeah.
storytelling. He's not much for storytelling.
No, no, he's not. He's like, no, this is what Yeshua said. That's it. Okay. I also really appreciate in the commentary, it talks about a passerby is someone who inherently is living very deeply in the present moment. They have their full attention where they are, because this moment is not something they can revisit. They don't get to come back here again and again and again. So they're living fully and completely in the present moment, which, you know, is a hot topic these days in a variety of different spiritualities and religions. Mm-hmm. Present-mindedness, mindfulness, that essence that, okay, you're doing the dishes again, because you do the dishes at least two or three times a day, and you have for the last 40 years. Okay, you're here again, standing in front of the sink again. But this sink of dishes will never be recreated. This feeling exactly right now of the water and the bubbles on your hands, this feeling in your spine and in your hips and in your feet, this moment where you're taking a deep breath and feeling the sun through the windows, or in my case, feeling the small fan blowing on you and cooling you down. This moment is precious and priceless, and you'll never actually be here again. You will never be here again. So be here.
Yeah, but you have to make choices. At every moment in your life, you are making choices as to what you're going to continue to do, what you're going to do next, how you're feeling about it, et cetera. So,
yeah, yeah. Be passersby. That's one to struggle with and really wrestle with and be like, Jesus, did you really say that? And if you did, what were you thinking? You know, I am an advocate of arguing with God. I feel it advances the relationship. Because even though you might get angry at God, and you might say things that you think later, well, maybe that was a little irreverent, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Any conversation with God is better than no conversation with God.
But the problem is that it's always a one-sided conversation.
Oh, I don't believe that. It's tricky because God doesn't necessarily seem to be standing just to my right in the way that, say, Liz Brauza Hughes could walk into my office and stand just to my right and be like, Sarah, why are you here? What are you doing? I thought you were going on vacation. And we could have a conversation about that. And I could say, actually, I'm leaving on Saturday. It's fine. We can have a dialogue in a very physical, human way that only mystics seem to be able to do with God. But that does not mean that only mystics get to have a dialogue with God. It just might look different. And God's response may be that feeling of joy we just talked about. God's response may be the next song on the radio and our sudden insight. And it doesn't have to be a pop song with lyrics that tell you, go and do that. It could be Vivaldi's Winter, which reminds you, if you're that uncomfortable, Jeanette, turn the air conditioning up. It's not the end of the world. Just for today, turn the air conditioning up. Now, did Antonio Vivaldi write that song just to tell you on July 20th to turn the air conditioning up? Of course he didn't. But can the spirit of God that is inside of you interpret all outside stimuli to give you realizations? Oh, yes. And some of us find it most clearly in the actual Bible. read the Word of God every day, get a little nugget from it. Some of us don't find it most clearly in the Bible, and that's okay too.
When I leave the house, I always ask God to come with me. Mm-hmm. When I come back safely, I know he has answered me.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. That's cool. That's valid. Any conversation we have with God is better than no conversation we're having with God.
Bye.
Let's look at one more. This one's a bit longer, but then everyone is compared to saying 42. I'll go ahead and read this one. The disciples asked him, "Who are you to say these things to us?" Yeshua replied, "Do you not know me from what I say to you? Or have you become like those Judeans? If they love the tree, they despise the fruit. If they love the fruit, they despise the tree." Let's let that sink in for a moment of silence. What do you think of saying 43?
Well, number one, I can't believe that they would ask him that.
Yes. They got some butt spa there, huh?
So if they love the fruit, they despise the tree. If you love the fruit, you're picking it off the tree. You're taking things away from the tree that grew that. So
I think essentially he's saying that, Jesus is saying that you're not listening to me. You're really not understanding and thinking about, you know, what I'm saying to you.
Yeah, because taking the fruit from the tree, the words he's saying from him, you're not diminishing the tree at all.
Mm-hmm.
You're helping it to grow, and if you take the fruit and share it with somebody, it's growing and growing. So it would seem to me that loving the tree and despising the fruit is a no-win.
It's hard to understand, right?
Well, it's just not a winner at all.
Yeah, like how can you love Jesus and yet dislike, you know, what he says and does, you know?
Right.
Let me give you an example of this statement that may make it clearer to you. Because you're right. If they love the tree, they despise the fruit. If they love the fruit, they despise the tree. That's not a saying we have these days. But let's think of the civil rights era for a moment in the US. In the civil rights era, there was a disconnect for many Americans who might recognize that something Martin Luther King Jr. said was good, reasonable, acceptable, if they didn't know it was him saying it. But if they knew that it was him saying it, no, because he was a Black man and they couldn't respect Black men. They couldn't respect Black people of any gender. So right there is an example of love the tree, despise the fruit. We would call that hypocrisy or a lack of integrity. It's not quite a similar saying that I grew up with. Love the child, hate the action. That's a little bit different, even though it seems very familiar. Because then you're looking at the person who's doing a thing you disapprove of, but you're not vilifying the person. And it's very specifically one way. It's an action that is despicable and a person who is lovable. And it's not a person who is despicable and an action that is lovable. It's never used in that way. It's only used in the one way. But what Jesus is talking about here is a huge disconnect of integrity. When you can look at a person and say, wow, aren't they great? Aren't they fabulous? They're so wise. They're so good. They're so holy. And then they say something and you're like, no, no, never, never. Who are you again? Or similarly, when you hear about something someone has said, and you're like, wow, that's an amazing saying. Who is this person who just spouts wisdom and wonder and fabulousness? And then you understand, oh, that was Thich Nhat Hanh. No, 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 no. I can't accept any of that because he's Buddhist. Well, he was Buddhist. He's now dead. And I only listen to Christian people. I only listen to Christian wisdom. And I don't believe that other religions can understand in any deep way any profound truth that will help anyone in any fashion. Now, we might look at that kind of mindset and say, that's not a person I want to have coffee with. That's not a person I want to really be around. Okay, that's fine. But that's the disconnect that Jesus was referring to. That we don't have that disconnect as writ large in our lives is a testament to our growth as a community. It still may be there on the fringes. Sue, what are you going to say?
I think it's not just there in the fringes. I think we hide it very neatly. I think it's there in full force, just like it was in the civil rights.
Hmm. Okay, that's a good point too. We have a blind eye to the places where it is, perhaps, would be a better way to think about it. Until, yeah, of course, we look at it and it's brought to our attention, then we don't have a blind eye anymore.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good point.
And so Jesus, this saying then, is about Jesus saying, don't be like that.
Yeah.
Don't be like that.
Open your eyes and let that be the light of your brain.
If you think I'm wise, then listen to what I say. If you think that what I say is wise, then just accept that it's coming from a Galilean, which, of course, it was common to disregard Galileans, country folk.
What do they know?
Exactly. Yeah. Final thoughts on saying 43.
This whole little grouping that we've just kind of come across today and your comments on it, your guidance through it, leaves us with a lot to think about while you're gone.
Yeah, and it hangs together too. That's, yeah, right. You're going to be on vacation for 1 week, right? And then you'll be back?
I am going to be on vacation for 2 weeks.
Okay, so the next 2 weeks, no Bible study.
The next,
okay,
2 weeks, no Bible, okay, study.
Mm-hmm. So we can catch up on the podcast.
Yeah. Yes, you can catch up on the podcast. They're all up there.
Yeah. And before we part company now, in terms of my audio, can you understand what I'm saying perfectly?
Perfectly.
Okay. No fading in and out or breaking up or anything. Okay.
Wonderful.
Okay. Wonderful. I'll use my tablet now on then. Okay.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Thank God.
Yes. It must be a relief just to solve the problem.
Yes. Yeah, well, it's not salt. I just use a different tool.
right.
My tablet, not my computer. So,
and that's interesting.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Well, ladies, thank you very much for joining me. And mm-hmm. I will see you in 2 weeks.
And have a great 2 weeks. Be safe.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Do enjoy. Do enjoy. Yes.
I will do my best not to be gored by a bison. Here we go.
Peace.
All right.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.